Hello, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to talk about a book called Drink What You Want, The Subjective Guide to Making Objectively Delicious Cocktails by John DeBerry. I know what you're probably thinking. This is a podcast about wine books. Well, I mean, to be fair, we did say that it was a podcast. I mean, it's called Reading and Drinking, so I guess we never explicitly stated that it would be about wine books. And this is the middle book of our second season. And so if we're going to take a slight divergence off of the theme of reviewing books about wine, I think it is okay to review a book about cocktails. This episode is sponsored by Blind Tasting Sessions. The third season of Blind Tasting Sessions launches February 14th, and the theme is all about spouses. Spouses in the wine industry. If you want to catch this series, then you can subscribe. Psalm TV is $5.99 a month or $49.99 for the entire year. Blind Tasting Sessions and all kinds of other incredible content is yours for the picking. Now, depending on what your role is, if you work in the hospitality industry, if you're a sommelier or a beverage director or a manager, or even just a beverage alcohol enthusiast, chances maybe are that you don't just consume wine and are interested in wine. You might actually enjoy cocktails or spirits. And I certainly do. I worked as a beverage director and bar director and a bartender at times throughout my career. And I have a great affection for cocktails. I make them at home. I enjoy them and I like learning about them. And this book is brand new. It came out in 2020. It is a hardback book. It's about 6.5 inches by 9 inches. And the cover illustration it's a margarita on the rocks. And this book doesn't have photographs, but it has wonderful, colorful illustrations that depict the drinks and environments and kind of themes throughout this book. So the author is John DeBerry. And a little bit of his backstory, like many of us, I guess, kind of accidentally got into the restaurant and bar industry, but he worked at a bar in New York called PDT, which, if you're not familiar, stands for Please Don't Tell. And this is a pretty impactful and famous bar. And I know, you know, I miss going to bars. I don't know how anyone out there feels about it, but I love bars. I like sitting at the bar. I like eating at bars, you know, talking to a bartender, seeing what they're, you know, what they're excited about and new products. And PDT was a pretty impactful bar. And it opened in, I think, 2007. And it really was kind of a harbinger of craft cocktail bars. And it was opened by a really impactful man named Jim Meehan, who's no longer involved. But the cool thing about PDT, if you've never been, is that it's a speakeasy. So it's like a hidden location. I mean, it's not that hidden. This is a heralded one of the world's 50 best bars type situation. But to enter into PDT, there's actually a secret entrance inside a hot dog, you know, restaurant called Criff Dogs. And inside the hot dog joint was a phone booth. And then you would enter in through the phone booth, reservations only, small, no standing area. I've been, it's really cool. Also, the hot dogs are really good. So John DeBerry worked for years at PDT. And then he also worked at Momofuku Sambar, which is part of the David Chang empire. And then eventually left PDT to be the bar director for the Momofuku group. And he has since left. He's got his own company, but this, I believe, is his first book. There's an intro by Jim Meehan. And I've eaten and drunk at both of those places, at PDT and at Momofuku Sambar and other restaurants in the Momofuku group. So I've never met this author, but I guess theoretically it's possible that he has made or served me a drink that I've enjoyed. And those are some pretty influential and impactful places. So this guy on the face, he's got a pretty legit resume and skill set. So this book it's organized the way a lot of cocktail books are. It starts off with a foreword, introduction to the author, and then it covers sort of the groundwork about him, about you, about this book, what a cocktail is. For purposes of this book, a cocktail is defined as a beverage where at least two ingredients are combined together. Now, other people will have a cocktail defined as, you know, spirit and sugar and water and things of that nature. And one thing that pervades through this book is the information is historical, it's entertaining, it's accurate, but there's also a constant kind of qualification that if the choice is between accuracy and deliciousness, then the author is going to go for what he likes and for deliciousness over technical historical accuracy. But in terms of background information, there is an analysis objectively of what deliciousness is. based on the objective categories and the subjective categories of how we would determine if something is delicious, how to make a balanced cocktail and what that really means. And then the meat of this book, the heart of this book, is a whole series of chapters that are broken up into themes. And each theme contains different cocktails, an illustration of the cocktail, a recipe, and then also what I like to call laterals. So if you like this, then you should try that. And this is something that we see in wine books. And I think it's very helpful because it's a way to expand the reach beyond what's just detailed within these pages. There's also a really just a small inclusion about what you need to make cocktails at home, because this book is, I think, technically geared towards the home bartender. Though if you are an industry professional, I think you would still have a lot to learn and get out of this book. And it's in that first chapter about ingredients where the author makes some really good points. So there's some basic equipment that most everybody is going to need if you plan on making cocktails. Certainly if you plan on making the cocktails in this book. And there's no reinventing of the wheel here. A shaking tin set, jiggers, a bar spoon, knives, things of that nature. But there are, if you want to get, you know, into the cocktail world minutiae, there are specific tools that are used for specific styles of drinks. And in this instance, I'm talking about strainers. So you mix a drink up in your shaking tin, your two parts, one small, one large tin cups, or one could be a pint glass. That's certainly fine. But there's two major styles of strainers. And one is called a Hawthorne strainer. You've probably seen it. It's like, it looks like a metal lollipop with holes in it. And on the underside of it, it's like a little slinky. And the idea there is that little spring or slinky kind of fits inside the shaking tin, and it can catch any bits of herbs or fruit or things like that that you might not want in your finished drink. There's another kind of strainer called a julep strainer, and it's like a metal saucer with bigger holes. And the idea is the julep strainer you would use to strain a stirred cocktail that doesn't have any of those bits, no citrus juice, no herbs, just off the ice and into a glass. And he makes a really good point. He says, every new bartender is told they need to use two different strainers, julep for stirred and Hawthorne for shaken. You can use the Hawthorne for both. So there's absolutely no functional reason why you need a julep strainer in your life. I mean, he makes a really valid point. So early on, I was like, I never thought about that. And I am a proponent of not just buying things because you think you need them. Now, full disclosure, I own both. But I like that because if you have limited kitchen space or limited storage or a limited budget and you want to develop your own stuff, you know what? Be empowered. You don't need to have every tool under the sun to make all of these cocktails. Now, throughout this book, there are notations and footnotes. And it's not because the footnotes are leading you to another reference or something like that. It's like the inner monologue of the author. And they are hilarious. You should read all the footnotes. Generally, I think you should read the footnotes in books, but in this book, you should definitely read the footnotes because the book is written in first person. And so he's talking very kind of directly to you, the reader. And it's just, there's a little bit of snark, but not in a condescending way. There's a fair amount of sarcasm. And it might not resonate with everybody, but it cracked me up. You know, some of the equipment that you need to make cocktails, he mentions mugs. And he says, you know, I suspect you already have mugs around your house for tea and coffee, but I've yet to visit a house where there is any kind of consistent coffee mug program. Yeah, that's right. I said coffee mug program. There's an asterisk. And he said in the bottom, in the footnote, he says, I'll be the first person to tell you that I'm a pretentious dick. And he's just talking about mugs to use for like eggnog or hot drinks or something like that. And I read that and I was like, oh, I see. Okay, this is truly an introduction to the author. But this is in a later chapter that's not even detailing who he is and his background. So read the footnotes. It's a really funny kind of inclusion. Anyway, after we get through the kind of the background, how to stir and how to shake and why you would stir and why you would shake, the first cocktail that's detailed in this book is a daiquiri. Now, daiquiri is a pretty ubiquitous cocktail. I love daiquiris. In a restaurant group that I used to work for, there was kind of an unspoken little thing called a daiquiri timeout, where it was like a little mini cocktail that could be sent to guests if you needed to buy some time or just, you know, have them chill out for a little bit while they were waiting for a table or if things are running behind. And for what it's worth, the daiquiri that we're talking about is not the frozen kind. We're talking about the true classic cocktail. And I love classic cocktails. There's a recipe for a daiquiri. If you need it, there's a recipe for simple syrup, which is one of three ingredients in a daiquiri. It's an incredibly simple, straightforward, delicious cocktail. And then moves through like a greatest hits of what Jill likes to drink. An old fashioned, a Manhattan, a martini, a margarita, and a highball is the next. And every now and then we're introduced to kind of a new concept or a new term that the author mentions. And in the highball, it's not a chapter, in the highball page, he talks about what he calls a soda sandwich. So a highball, if you're not familiar, is a drink in a tall glass. It's a long drink, as one might say, and it's served over ice. And so as it is traditionally, a highball is just whiskey and soda water. And there's a little bit more to it than that if you actually want to make a good one. But one of the things the author talks about is that depending on the type of bubbly water that you use, seltzer, soda, sparkling mineral water, depending on what style, the bubbles tend to dissipate pretty quickly and can go flat. And so he always recommends filling your glass with a little bit of soda and then adding the spirit and then topping with the soda. That is a soda sandwich. And I've never done it before, but it just makes a lot of sense to me. So the idea of deliciousness, because this is a kind of a theme that is routinely revisited throughout this book, is a challenging one. And it's kind of dissected into the objective ways that you can look at deliciousness. How sweet is the drink? Is it too strong? Is it too bitter? And then there's the subjective way of looking at a drink. Do you like it? And this really resonates with me because when it comes to cocktails, it's very much like baking as opposed to cooking. You know, if you're cooking like a stew or, I don't know, I'm not much of a cook, but you can just taste and season and throw a little bit more of this and a little bit more of that. But when it comes to baking, it's very precise and with measurements. And you can certainly take both of those approaches to making cocktails. You can just free pour and eyeball it, but you can also be very precise and measure everything, which is, of course, why a jigger is listed as one of the critical items that you need for your home bar. And this really resonates with me because I don't think I would say it that same way. But for me, when I'm drinking cocktails, I love classics. I love kind of straightforward and simple cocktails, and I like the flavor of spirits. And so I like, I guess, strong drinks. I also like bitter things, but I have what I like to call the two cocktail rule. So there could be a drink that objectively is correct. It's measured, it's precisely made, it's presented attractively, and it's made according to the recipe. And it might be interesting and correct. Objectively, it should be delicious. But if you don't like it, if you take your three sips and you say, I'm good, you don't want to order a second drink, then subjectively, is it delicious to you? And that's a really important thing to consider. And look, the author, he recognizes that he talks about what he finds delicious and also what he does not. One of my favorite cocktails that's listed in this kind of objective section is The Last Word. It's the last cocktail. It's one of my absolute favorite cocktails. It's equal parts gin, lime juice, maraschino liqueur, and green chartreuse. It's not for everybody. And in fact, the author hates it. He won't drink it, but he knows that objectively it should be delicious. And theoretically, he should like it. He just does not care for those flavors. And so I think it's a very thoughtful analysis of what makes a drink delicious. And your own personal opinion is critical. I mean, the name of the book is Drink What You Want. So you will get information and you'll learn about technique. And there's some hilarious storytelling in this book, but also you do have to make those decisions for yourself. Now, the book is not perfect. No book ever is. I found one whole error. And because the author says that, and I mentioned this early on, that if there was a choice between historical accuracy and what he likes or creativity, he's going to default to the latter. There are certainly, you could make arguments for his recipe not being the, you know, the cast in stone, tried and true original recipe, but nothing was glaring. There was one tiny little snafu, and it's in a mention of aromatized and fortified wines. It's a book about cocktails. Yes, wine is used in cocktails, and there were some misstatements about sherry. It's not egregious. It's teeny tiny, but, you know, it caught my eye. From the objective section of cocktails, we move into classics. So a lot of those objectively delicious and balanced cocktails are, in fact, classic, but this book covers a lot of ground. From there, we move into Sazeracs and Sidecars, and one of my favorite trios of cocktails, the Negroni, Boulevardier, and Old Pal combo. These are cocktails that are made essentially with the same proportions, but just with a slight variation with regard to the base spirit or a vermouth, and you can make three distinctive cocktails. But it's this idea that with a little bit of riffing, if you just kind of substitute out one ingredient or another, then you can really expand both your consuming repertoire, but also your knowledge repertoire. And that's a theme that's consistent throughout this book, this idea of riffing. Now, there's a lot, the first half of this book is very, well, it's very entertainingly academic. But there are a few chapters in this book that I love. I just unabashedly love. And there's some really good suggestions in here. And I feel like this is maybe going to shed a little bit of light on, I don't know, on my personality, but I'm not scared. So there's an entire chapter called Feeling Lazy. And he says that laziness is a virtue. It's not to be confused with sloth. Laziness is simply the desire to avoid unnecessary work. So these are recipes that are easy and involve what he calls high value, low work steps. So they're not complicated. So like the author really likes rye in Manhattans, but I like bourbon. I mean, rye is great too, but I tend to make them with bourbon. And so I was for a while, you know, once it got cold and I was switching to brown liquor, I would, you know, I had my bourbon and my delicious sweet vermouth and my Luxardo cherries and my couple dashes of bitters. And I was stirring them in my mixing glass with my cocktail spoon. And I was using a julep strainer and straining into my beautiful cocktail coupe. And then I guess the laziness took over because hashtag 2020. And I would just be like eyeballing it into a rocks glass and putting some ice in there and like stir it with my finger. Because I guess washing off a mixing glass and bar spoon was like too much work. So I this book resonates so deeply with me. And again, I might have revealed far too much about my personality there, but this is how it goes, folks. Now, this book definitely has plenty of complicated cocktails, the kind of stuff that you would probably order at Momofuku or at PDT. And frankly, they're not the kind of thing that I want to make at home because I guess I'm just a little bit too lazy. But there is some genius stuff in here. And look, I can't say it on the podcast, but there is also in the personal commentary from this author, it is hilarious. It is F-wording hilarious. It's a little bit dirty. It's a little bit raunchy. And it totally made me laugh out loud on more than one occasion. So just beware. This is not a PG-rated book. There are some, you know, not safe for the children, but I mean, what child is going to be reading a book about cocktails? But there is some raunchy, lewd hilariousness in this book. So just buckle up. But for example, the first drink where some of this raunchiness comes into play is Death in the Afternoon, which is a fantastic cocktail. I love it. And it couldn't be easier. He says it kind of barely makes the cutoff to be considered a cocktail because all you really need to make a Death in the Afternoon, a favorite of Ernest Hemingway, by the way, is champagne, a little bit of absinthe, and a touch of simple syrup, which is optional. So if we go back to the definition for this book of a cocktail being two ingredients combined together for a beverage, champagne and absinthe, it literally could not be more easy. But there are some drinks in here that maybe might catch you off guard. I should say there are more than one blue cocktail in this book. The author has zero chill about admitting that he loves blue curacao, which is a bitter orange flavored liqueur. Regular orange curacao or orange liqueur is typically clear or has a light golden color, but that blue one, it makes its way into a bunch of cocktails in this book. But there is a section in here on an amaretto or a Midori sour, which, look, those drinks, as he says, might be considered tacky, but they're also delicious when they're made correctly. And he makes a really good analogy here. He says, are you thinking that the only thing grosser than an amaretto sour is a Midori sour? Now, amaretto is an almond-flavored liqueur, and Midori is that like bright green Japanese melon-flavored liqueur. I'm fairly sure the last time I had Midori, I was in college, but, you know, just it is what it is. And he said, not so. Just as you can have really good pizza and really shitty pizza, the fault is not in the idea of what a pizza is, but rather in the execution. These drinks fail when people don't know how to use liqueurs properly and end up making something too sweet. And I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, is this going to lead you to go to your liquor store and buy Midori and start making Midori sours? I mean, it's really easy. So if you are lazy like I am, all it takes is Midori, some fresh lime juice, and an egg white. You know, it's a really easy drink to make, but I love that it got included. But the star of this chapter is something that he calls the meal prepper martini. Now, I'm not a great cook, but it is nice to have a glass of wine or a cocktail in your hand and some music on the stereo when you're cooking, whether for yourself or for, you know, a small bubble group of people. But, you know, it's not hard to make a martini. It's gin and vermouth and maybe a twist of lemon. It's maybe some olives. It's really an easy cocktail to make, But if you are lazy and if you've been working hard and you are tired and you just want something cold and refreshing to sip on, he lays it all out. And he says, it's basically a cocktail equivalent of meal prepping on a Sunday night, you know, where you cook up a whole batch of food and you portion it out. And so you've got your meals ready for the week. He says, you do the exact same thing. You take a 750 milliliter bottle of gin. You take a 375 milliliter bottle of dry vermouth, about a quarter of an ounce of orange bitters. And the key ingredient here is 375 milliliters of filtered water. So you take the gin, the vermouth, the water, and the bitters. You combine it all in a large, a Cambro, a large mixing bowl. And then you can actually put it back into the bottles of the gin and the vermouth. You have to leave a little bit of space for some expansion, but this is alcohol. And the little bit of water is going to make it, you know, a little bit more inclined to freeze. Pure alcohol won't freeze, but wine certainly can. And when you add a little bit of water, it will. And so the idea is that this will make 12 drinks. And you can pour it back into the gin bottle, the vermouth bottle, and then a little bit of extra. Keep it for a couple of weeks, and you have your meal prepper martini like ready to go. You pull the bottle out of the freezer. It's already mixed. It's already perfectly cold. I mean, it's so simple, but it's so genius. So that's definitely something that I'm going to be working into my repertoire. Now, there are a couple chapters on some of his original creations from his time at PDT and Momofuku. And look, I'll be really honest. I'm not trying to replicate those cocktails. Sometimes, you know, in the fancy chapter, they are fancy drinks. They involve a lot of steps. And it might be kind of a fun thing to replicate. I was totally charmed by the fact that in this fancy category, he details a drink that he created called a Black Diamond, which was inspired by the red wines of Bordeaux. And I was like, oh my God, years ago, when I was running a beverage program for a company in DC, I actually created a cocktail that was inspired by red wine also. It wasn't inspired by the red wines of Bordeaux. It was inspired by the red wines of the Northern Rhone Valley. But I was like, oh, I feel a kinship with this man who I've never met, because we have both used inspiration for wine to create cocktails. Now, there's a section on party drinks, like holiday drinks, including some things like, you know, large format beverages like punches. And one day when we are able to return to, you know, house parties and holiday parties in person, not over Zoom, you know, break out your punch bowl and make some large format cocktails. There is a section in here. It's called Feeling Sober, and it's all non-alcoholic cocktails. The author detailed in an interview that I found online that he does these kind of unique to him things where for a year at a time, he'll just give something up. And so bless his soul, for 2020, he gave up alcohol. Of all the years to give up alcohol, I don't know that many people probably did. I think the opposite. I think consumption certainly increased for most people. Or he'll say, like, you know, for a year he gave up buying new clothes, or he would only reread books that he'd read. So he's kind of a quirky individual. But the drinks in here are really delicious. And look, sometimes you don't want to drink alcohol, or you choose not to, or you can't. And my major complaint with non-alcoholic cocktails, aside from the horrible name mocktail, that's my biggest complaint. But aside from that, a lot of times they're really heavy. I've worked in restaurants before where there has been like a non-alcoholic flight of beverages. And sometimes it gives me the impression that it would be like a V8 followed by another slightly different flavor V8 followed by another flavor V8, because there's a lot of fruit and there's a lot of vegetables. And that might be too much fruit. You know what I'm saying? But these are very creative. They sound incredibly refreshing. And I stuck a little post-it note on the page for the black pineapple elixir, which is pineapple juice and black pepper syrup and some tonic water. I mean, that sounds really good to me. I like all of those things. So that's one that my lazy ass might actually be able to try. Now, after the feeling fancy and the large formats and the feeling festive, there is my second favorite chapter in this entire book, and it's called Feeling Desperate. Now, the whole premise here is that, and he says, desperation is about making compromises in order to make the best of a suboptimal situation. These are not drinks that he hopes you will make. He's just saying, look, if you want a cocktail and you're in a less than optimal situation, I'm going to give you some starting blocks. So for example, the first drink in this chapter is what's called a melted firecracker margarita. If you're familiar with the firecracker ice pops, like when ice cream trucks like go around, it's like a bomb pop is how I always called it. They're red, white, and blue. So there's like, it's like the white is like lemon, and then there's like blue raspberry and cherry or strawberry, some red fruit flavor. And so the idea, and it's illustrated completely appropriately with an inverted popsicle in a red Solo cup. And it's two firecracker popsicles melted and an ounce of Blanco tequila. And you can use the firecracker or the bomb pop popsicle stick as your stirrer. So look, if you are in between a rock and a hard place and all you have is popsicles and tequila, you're fine. You're square. And sometimes the cocktails are actually the desperation cocktails. They're pretty straightforward and they could certainly yield a classic drink. But oh my God, the funniest thing I read in this entire book, which is saying something because this book is funny, is in this desperation chapter, and it is called, it's called a desperation michelada. Now, a michelada, if you are not familiar, it's a beer cocktail. So you combine beer and hot sauce and lime. Sometimes people put in like Bloody Mary mix, but the critical component is that there's a little bit of a spicy character. There's some citrus notes, and it's a beer-based cocktail. It is delicious. It's one of my favorite brunch drinks. And when you make it correctly with, you know, proper care and good ingredients, it is fantastic. But this is not that drink. And he says, look, I don't expect anyone to make this drink on purpose. I hope no one sets out to make this drink. I'm including it. So if you find yourself in a situation that involves access to ketchup, shitty beer, and little else, i.e., if you're in a frat house or at a minor league baseball game, you could still make a semi-decent cocktail. So the recipe is 12 to 16 ounces bland lager beer, which is generally my personal preference. I say that I like industrial American lagers in cans. Actually, industrial worldly lagers in cans. It doesn't have to be just American. So you take your 12 to 16 ounces of beer, 2 packets of ketchup, 3 or 4 dashes of hot sauce. The preferred brand is Cholula with a little wooden cap, a pinch of salt, a pinch of freshly ground black pepper, and an optional garnish of a lime wedge. All you have to do is combine all the ingredients to stir and mix, though you could make this drink in the can. You would just have to take a couple sips of beer out to make room for everything else and then give it a little sloshy slosh and mix it all up. Look, I'm not entirely sure I want to try this, but I love that this is out there. And, you know, sometimes industrial bland lager, it's kind of sweet. It's maybe not that delicious. And so if you're trying to make it a little bit better and you need a little kind of sweetened acidic zing from the ketchup and a little bit of kind of piquant character from the hot sauce and lime, go wild. I died reading this. I thought it was one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. Now, the book ends after all these different chapters. There's an appendix. There's a couple of appendices. And the first appendix is what's called balance exercises. And I think that this is really great. It details daiquiri 3 ways and an old-fashioned 3 ways. So it kind of brings back full circle the first couple cocktails that this book talks about. But it's just about how adjusting the ingredients, the amount of rum, the amount of lime juice, or the amount of simple syrup, and how you could make all 3 of those things because it's just the exact same ingredients, just in different proportions. And then you can taste them. And then you can ask yourself, how perceptible are the individual ingredients? How balanced is it in terms of acidity or sweetness or alcohol? Is it too strong? Is it too watery? Also, which is your favorite? Because these are classic cocktails and they can be riffed off of endlessly. And so you can find, you know what? Hey, I love a daiquiri, but I actually prefer a less sweet version. So I want less simple syrup and more lime juice, or, you know, I want a stronger drink. There is definitely that subjective and personal opinion that counts and is very important. And so taking 2 different cocktails that are, you know, prepared differently and 3 kind of versions of them can really help you kind of calibrate your own palate. And I think that that's a really thoughtful exercise that just about anyone who tried it could probably learn something from. And then after that is the second appendix, which is called Further Reading. And this just warmed up my little book reviewer heart. It details recommended reading, both cocktail books, drink books, and then science books. Some of these I own. Some of these are definitely going to be ordered. I can't say necessarily for this podcast, but for my own education and kind of interest as well. It's really fantastic. So what works in this book? I mean, just about everything. The author at some point, I'm not even sure where, but it could have been an interview I saw online or it could be in this book, but he says that he wants the book to first read like a book, to be storytelling and entertaining, and then secondly, to be sort of an education resource, and it totally achieves that goal. Every cocktail, there's an explanation for why it works or why something is made a certain way or incorporates a certain ingredient, details what that ingredient tastes like. There's a guide to major spirit categories, including recommended producers. There's so much information. You will definitely learn more, even if you're just, you know, a home bartender who has no interest in expanding the repertoire between beyond like the 9 classic cocktails that are first delivered. There are fun little tools. I mentioned the variations in the appendix of making 3 different versions, but there's also a flow chart that if you're stuck at your in-laws and there's a liquor cabinet full of dusty random bottles, there's a guide so you can navigate it and see what's there, what's not, and what your options are to make a semi-decent cocktail. If you are looking for cocktails for a specific occasion, whether that's oceanside or in a pool, you're covered. Again, if you are lazy or desperate, you are covered. There is literally something for everyone. And I guess I love reading books. I love reading books about beverage alcohol. I've got a bunch of books about cocktails and spirits. And I'm not entirely sure any of them has ever made me laugh out loud repeatedly. And this one did. It is so funny. Now, I get that humor is subjective. And so that and like, you know, as I mentioned, a little bit of raunchiness, it might not play well with everybody who's reading this book, but it's so funny and it's so well written and it really tells a great story. What doesn't work? Like hardly anything. I mean, I guess maybe his sense of humor or his sarcasm might not resonate with everybody. As I mentioned, you know, the footnotes are hysterical and you should read all of them. And I've talked in other book reviews before about how sometimes when there's a tone of snark or sarcasm, I don't like it. And it comes off as condescending or arrogant. That's not the case here. He's really self-deprecating. And so he talks also about how he's evolved as a person, how he used to be like that guy, that bartender that was a snob, and that somebody ordered a Manhattan, which is a delicious classic cocktail, which is made with bourbon or rye, sweet vermouth and bitters. And they're like, oh, I don't want the sweet vermouth, that he would make it for them and hand it to them and tell them, here is your, you know, your rye and bitters. You know, like he wouldn't even call it by a Manhattan because he was that guy. But he evolved and he learned. And look, we all evolve and we all learn. So he might have gone from being that, you know, like elbow gator wearing, you know, cocktail geek who looked down his, you know, his mixing tins at people at the end of the bar who didn't order drinks the way he liked them. And then he embraced all the stuff that is endemic to the hospitality industry and just went with it. And I think this book is a triumph. So for my rating, well, if you couldn't tell, I love this book. It was so great. And I love that right in the middle of this season of books about wine, broke with the theme, broke with tradition, picked up a brand new book about cocktails. And it was like the most refreshing, like boozy sorbet I could have ever imagined. This book is hilarious. It's wonderful. It's educational. It's aesthetically pleasing. And you should definitely buy this book. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. Be sure to subscribe. And if you like what you heard, feel free to leave us a rating. This episode was sponsored by Blind Tasting Sessions. Blind Tasting Sessions is a series on Somm TV and is about to launch its 3rd season. First episode kicks off on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And this season is all about spouses in the wine industry. So subscribe today to get all of this amazing content. Somm TV is $5.99 a month or $49.99 for the whole year.